Any question you have about that place? Anything more relevant?
Or about Pilaticus?
Or any other questions?
I was interested. Were you born during the war or after?
I was born in 1944.
Okay, so the year after your parents.
This 44 was. In fact, there's an interesting story my mother told me about the time that I was born. I was actually born in College Square. And I guess I was delivered by a midwife there. The house is still standing, it's renovated, it's lovely, in College Square. And I had a cousin,
yeah,
a child of my father's elder sister. She was born 2 months before me, see? And that's why, her mother and my mother got on very well because of common interests. Yeah? And my mother told me one incident which I think might have been the shock, the trauma that caused her to become partially hearing impaired, you know?
What happened?
Hard of hearing, I think. Mm-hmm. She said it was during, I think she was expecting me at that time then. She happened to open the window and she saw this bomb that was released by the Japanese plane coming towards them.
Okay.
And the shock was really bad, but fortunately she didn't have a miscarriage.
Yeah.
I don't think at the time I was born, it must have been in 43. And then, but fortunately the bomb whizzed past that building and landed further up behind. Wow. Yeah. So that was a memorable, I shouldn't say memorable. It's something that has stuck in my head for some time, you know, what she told me about her while they were living there.
Yeah.
And then during the Japanese time, of course, they had to grow their own food and so on, which I'm sure many people in Penang know about it, you know. And my father, and that's why until his old age, my father used to love to eat tapioca.
Yeah.
Because that was more or less their staple food.
Yeah.
And the field in front of College Square, it's a big field there. The people who were living around there, it became like a community garden.
Mm-hmm.
The plot in front of your house is where you grow your stuff. So they grow sweet, most of it was tapioca.
Yeah.
Until he was older, you know, he just loved to eat tapioca. So that was one of the things. Yeah. And then, anything else?
Did your parents talk about what it was like to live under a Japanese occupation, other than that story about the bomb?
Oh, yes.
What are some stories you remember?
A lot of stories. My mother used to say, actually, when they were already occupying Penang, and where, you know, if you were caught stealing, they just chopped off your hand sort of thing.
Yeah.
But she talked about the Japanese torture, which I don't want to talk about because it sounded so gruesome.
Yeah.
It was really very bad. Really, the people really suffered, you know. But the good thing was there were no thefts. In the sense that once whoever is caught, you just punish, you steal something, your hand is chopped off, that sort of thing. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Like an eye for an eye sort of thing.
Mm.
But he used to tell me that they could leave the doors wide open. When it was, what do you call it, blackout time, a curfew, and they had lights off, no lights now. And on a moonlit night, they would sit in the back lane with all doors wide open, just the moonlight, no worry about thieves at all, no worry about break-ins. That was the part that was, to her, it was something.
The silver lining.
The silver lining in that thing, you know. But times were hard then, you know. And I remember my mother telling me that her mother was a very rich person. Mm-hmm. Her parents were rich. My grandmother had lots of jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
But during the Japanese time when they were running and food, of course, was scarce, she had to sell her this krongsangs.
Mm-hmm.
One piece which today I think would cost a few hundred thousand to buy a bag of rice. It's either you forfeit, you lose that, or you starve.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah. At that time, of course, it was definitely very hard for them. And no jobs then, yeah. You see.
But they did meet working in the department store.
When there was sort of more, when the Japanese were really entrenched here and they started their business and so on. Yeah. And then with using the Japanese notes, the banana money, mm-hmm. you know, we call it. They worked in the department store. The department store, by the way, was called Daimaru.
Mm.
You know, the name, in case anybody needs to know what it is. It was called Daimaru, Daimaru. You know? It was a big department store. That's what I've been told.
Yeah.
And my mother's friends, as some were still around, even my cousins, says, your mom was such a genteel, like a porcelain doll.
Uh-huh.
She, you know, she couldn't kill an ant even if she stepped on it. That's how gentle she was, you know. They had lost, of course, they lost all their property, jewelry, so they were left to manage with what they had.
Yeah.
My parents managed at that time with the work, and then as we grew up, and then my father had his little pet's business, you know, for a while.
Yeah. Did your parents talk much about their love story or how they ended up together?
My mother did tell me a bit, but my father not so. I remember my grandmother.
Yeah.
She was a very, not loud, but rather... What is the word for it? Where if she gives one shout, I tell you, everybody cringes.
Yeah.
That sort of person.
Uh-huh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
And she didn't like my father, of course, as usual. My mother was the youngest mm-hmm. in the family, the prettiest and all that. And she was always... she never did any work, housework or anything.
Yeah.
Anywhere my grandmother went, my grandmother took her along.
Oh, okay.
She was the prettiest and... Yeah. That was before the Japanese occupation.
Huh? Yeah.
And then...
She's like her prize daughter.
That's right, yeah. You know.
How did they meet?
How did they meet?
Or their love story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when my mother started working at Daimaru, that's where she caught my father's eye. And at those days, they didn't have proper bicycles. I think they didn't have those bicycles, those high bicycles.
Uh-huh.
And they had a sidecar, what they call
sidecar. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So he would cycle past the house every now and then, stop there, and then to try and date her, you see.
Yeah.
And every time my grandmother saw him, she would chase him.
Oh, man. Why did she not like him?
Well, I guess she did like him. She did. Otherwise, she would not have married him. She did like him.
I mean, why did your grandmother not like him?
Because he was a different race.
Mm-hmm.
A different race altogether, you see.
Yeah.
So the prejudice is there.
Yeah.
But he's... Wow, he sweet-talked her into it. He managed to win her over.
Yeah.
You know? And I think he told, both of them told us, that they went through three different ceremonies in their marriage.
How long did they court for before they got married?
I'm not sure about that now.
Yeah.
They didn't tell me exactly how. It must have been about 2 or 3 years or something.
Okay,
you know?
Okay.
So anyway, they had one wedding, which was a Chinese tea ceremony, mm-hmm. the first one.
Mm-hmm.
It was that was the norm at that time.
Yeah, yeah,
in
yeah.
fact, there was no obligation to register the marriage or something, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
That was already legal. Then the second was they went to a registry.
Okay.
They had a registry marriage, and then with a Chinese dinner and so on.
Mm.
Yeah? And the third was at the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
a Catholic marriage. So my father used to say, that was very naughty of him. He used to say, I married 3 times to the same woman. I should have married once to 3 women.
Oh.
Typical of a Filipino talking that way. Well, anyway, that was the good times for them.
So your grandma did relent after a while.
Yes. And he was a very good son-in-law to her.
Yeah.
And she loved him.
Yeah.
You know, she loved him and liked him a lot and all that.
Was your mom Catholic before she met your dad?
No, she was converted.
Okay.
She was they were Buddhists, eh?
Okay.
And after, I think before they got married, she must have been baptized.
Yeah.
And my aunt's I'm not, well, yeah, my aunts. What are
they? On your mom's side?
My father's side, the two sisters.
Oh, yeah.
They loved my mom
yeah.
a lot.
Yeah.
They were very good to her. Yeah. And I, yes, I've been, this part is the part that flatters me. When I was born,
yeah.
you know, I had a cousin who was already born before me.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
when I was
right.
born, because I was the first child of my
yeah.
father, whom his two sisters loved so much. His
yeah.
two sisters doted on him. He was the youngest of the family.
Yeah.
So when I was born, I was a precious, like a doll, a precious
yeah.
child. And they were all always on hand to do something
yeah, yeah,
for
yeah.
me and to look after my mom and all that, you know,
yeah,
at that
yeah.
time. And one of my cousins, the eldest boy in that family,
yeah.
he told me the stories when we met, well, in 1990, I would say, or in the 80s, he told me, you know, when you were small, when you were a baby, I used to change your lumpen. so he must have been about 9, 10
yeah,
years old. So,
yeah.
right?
What language did your parents converse in?
English.
Okay, so they both knew English.
Yeah, in English. Oh, and then talking about the hats business. After a while, when the British left and so on, my father's business went down.
Mm.
The demand for hats,
yeah.
you know. And we went through a lot of hard times because it was difficult for them to get jobs. In fact, not only my father, I think at that period of time in the 50s, late 40s and 50s, jobs were difficult to come by, especially if you were not skilled, like let's say if you were trained as a doctor, lawyer,
yeah.
sort of, finding jobs was difficult. So we had very hard times for a while. And then my mom, who was when she was young, couldn't do a thing. Didn't even know how to boil water or cook rice. But as the saying goes, necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
She started sewing. She has this God-given gift of handwork. She's very good. She was very good at handwork. And she started sewing. She used to sew our clothes because we were four girls and two boys. The first, when we were the first, me and the second sister.
Yeah.
She learned that dressmaking from her sister-in-law.
Yeah.
Okay? And then she went into the dressmaking business.
Yeah, yeah.
She had a few very loyal customers.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how we went on,
yeah.
you see. And my father gave up the hats business and he went into another business, you know. But my mother then picked up the hat business.
Huh.
Because she was good at handwork.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But she modified it. Instead of making those huge picture
yeah, yeah.
hats that were quite required a lot of more skill, I would
yeah,
say.
Yeah.
She, what shall I say? What's the word for it when you start something new? A new brand or a new style. She styled her own hats,
uh-huh,
I'd say.
Uh-huh.
You know, she styled her own hats, which were smaller, more semi-formal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And her hats were in great demand. And we also learned how to make them. You know, we helped
yeah,
her
yeah.
with the stitching,
yeah,
the handwork
uh-huh.
and all that. And it was a really good business. And thank the Lord at that time, this came up about because my father didn't really make much, you know,
right,
on
yeah.
the other business. And to support six children, we were already
yeah.
six children at
yeah.
that time.
Yeah.
So my mom was the, well, I would say she brought in more.
more of the breadwinner.
Yeah, more of the breadwinner
yeah.
at that time. Huh?
Yeah.
So, and she did very well.
Yeah.
In fact, there is a newspaper article. Somebody, at that time, the Straits Echo, I think, did an article on her. You know? Well, very briefly. And one of the picture hats.
Yeah.
But the picture hat was actually made by my father.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And
yeah.
One of the...
Do you still have the article?
I have
maybe somewhere.
I'm not sure where I put
yeah,
it. It's
yeah.
in one of the huge albums. I'm not
yeah.
sure where I put it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's somewhere
yeah,
inside.
Yeah.
You see, that would be good to know.
Yeah.
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 yeah. yeah. yeah.
You mentioned earlier that when you were about 3 years old, your father's sisters left to go back to the Philippines.
Yes, that's right.
Was that part because they are escaping the war?
Oh, no, that was already after.
Oh, after the war.
So I was born in
44.
So by then, okay, the Japanese, yeah, and in fact, the Japanese had already moved out in 45, right? So they were still there. And they went back because they were not doing well. I mean, it was difficult for them to be, they were financially very tight.
Yeah.
So the alternative was to go back. And okay, I think they were not the only ones, quite a few.
Filipinos?
Quite a few Filipinos at that time went back. And those who stayed back because, like, the musicians and all this, music was still in demand. Mm-hmm. We know Filipino musicians rank among the top musicians in the world, even till today. They're good singers. My cousin used to say, you throw a stone, and when you go to Manila, you throw a stone, you'll hit a singer. Anyway, throw a stone, you'll hit a singer or a musician. Yeah, which is so true. So they went back because it was hard. So they had a different, they built a different life.
Right? Okay, so you didn't get to know them much because you were so young when they left?
No, I was too young to know who they were and all that. The only cousin that my father, because this cousin, he's already passed away, in his 60s. My father was like about 10 years older or so. Not very, the gap was not very wide between them, so they were very pally.
Yeah.
So my father used to communicate with him, you know. And after he went back, they all did well. Fortunately, they went back, they all did well. The children all had good education, and most of them had good jobs and so on. And he formed his own company. He started, of course, from very low down, but he built his own company, an oral care company. And 30 years later, he came back to Malaysia. You know, it was such a
to visit
my father. It was such a very poignant moment for the both of them. After 30 years,
because your father didn't see his sisters much after they left.
No, after they left, didn't see them at all.
Oh wow!
Because at that time, travel was
really
not
hard,
so easy,
and
then expensive, which we couldn't afford. You know, and so this cousin could already afford, so he came. And after he came, and then when my father's business was doing better, then only in my father visited the Philippines, I think during the PATA conference in 1971. 1971, that's right. This cousin came the first visit after that, after they left, after 30 years.
Yeah.
In 19... Oh dear, I can't remember now. Well, anyway, it was 30 years later. About 30 years later. So then my father went back, and then of course, he was very welcome. And then he read, I've got so many nieces, grandnieces, so
huge family.
Huge family, very huge family. They're still around. In fact, among them there in the Philippines, they don't even know each other because, you know, the one generation after another, they don't meet, so they don't know who the relatives are.
Did your father's siblings, they all stayed in the Philippines, none of them went to other countries?
Many of them went to the States.
Oh, okay.
They migrated to the States. Not his siblings, sorry. Not his siblings, because they could not afford them, you know.
Yeah.
His nephews.
Nephews.
His nephews. Quite a few. They still are there. And nieces too.
So there's quite a bit of family you don't know.
Yes, quite a few.
Yeah.
I think I have to say I only know one cousin well. The one who came after the 30.
After the 30 years. Were any of your other siblings born during the occupation?
No,
your
the next
sister.
I was born in 44. The second sister was born in 46, by which time the Japanese had already left.
And the British had come back.
The British came back in 45, I think.
I'm not sure.
So it was a different scenario already, a different setting and all that. So the next one was in 49, and then comes 49, 50, 51, one after the other.
Yeah.
And then Uncle Ling was 50, 57.
Okay.
In 57.
Yeah. Mm. Were you guys living in Pulau Tikus during that whole time? I remember at some point you moved to Penang Road, right?
Yes. I must have, like I said, about the time just before my aunties went back to the Philippines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My two aunties and their families went
back.
We moved to Penang Road.
Okay.
Which is this huge building there.
Yeah,
which is,
I've seen it. Yeah.
What is it called now?
It's called Little. They have the Little Penang Fair festival.
Ah, yes.
Last Sunday of every month.
Right in front of the house.
Yeah.
Right,
it's one of those. I think right now it's like bars and restaurants.
Yes, yes. It is a strong, sturdy building. Oh, we had wonderful childhood days there.
Yeah.
That area was so open, we could run around without fear of traffic and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that road from the church, from the Assumption Church, past St. Xavier's, and then that road that goes to, is it called Northern Road? Light Street? Not Lead Street, anyway, that road, particular road. It was a big field where all the children of the neighborhood used to go and play. They used to catch fish, catch frogs, find, look for marbles there, fly kites there. It was such a beautiful place. We were also safe. And every evening you'll find like 20, 30 children running around, groups of us, you know.
So the area was all residential when you were young, mostly?
It wasn't residential. There's a row of shops there.
Okay.
That they were all had businesses, little antique shops.
Okay. Okay.
Antique shops, shops that sold goods from China.
Mm-hmm.
China antiques like vases, porcelain, mm-hmm. and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a dry cleaners at the corner. There was a coffee shop. And then, of course, the people who did the business stayed there. They stayed upstairs. They stayed upstairs and the shop was downstairs.
Were your parents doing their business at that time?
At that time, my mom was doing the hats business then.
Okay.
When we were staying in Penang Road,
my
father had the hats business then. You know, he was doing the hats. And after, I think he stopped doing the hats in somewhere in 55 or so. 55 or 1955.
Okay. So it was like about 10, 15 years.
Yes, and then my mother took over.
Okay.
You see, my mother did her hats business there.
Because the trend was changing from bigger to smaller hats.
Yeah, the trend bigger to smaller hats.
Yeah.
And then the bigger hats were worn mainly by the British ladies when they went to the races.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
At that time. And then after the British left, there was definitely no demand for that.
Yeah.
And there was this place called White Oase in Bishop Street, where he used to get his stuff, all his materials for the hats, see? The veils, the lovely veils and flowers and so on. So gradually, the scene changed.
Yeah. Fashion
demand,
changes.
Fashion changed, demand changed. So it was different. And my mother made more hats, like for church-going hats, little...
Smaller.
More, what do you call now, fascinators. Mm. In England, they call them fascinators. That sort of hats my mother used to make, you know. And if you look at that picture over there, you see the headdress that my sister's wearing?
Yeah,
my mom made that.
In the wedding photo. Like veils.
The wedding veil, short veils. Mm-hmm. She made short veils.
Yeah.
She made my wedding headdress and the other two sisters' wedding headdresses. Yeah. So, but my father stopped there, then he went into the tourism business.
Oh, okay. What did he do?
He used to conduct tours to Bangkok. First, it started with Singapore. I think the first trip he made was in 1959. I think it was 59. Uh-huh. 1959, where he conducted a tour to Singapore.
And who was part of the tour? Local Malaysians?
Local, the Penang people. You know, at that time, conducted tours were not known yet.
Yeah.
It's just starting off. Yeah, you know? Was just starting off, and he had a financier.
Uh-huh.
He was doing the operations, you know, the running around of the tours. You know? I suppose he came and he found that he enjoyed doing it.
Yeah,
you know? And he did well. He did, and then from the Singapore trips, he went into Bangkok.
So there are periods where you wouldn't see him. He was off doing his tours.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. When he went to Bangkok this trip, he had never been to Bangkok before.
And he did a tour there.
He had to go on his own first.
Oh, okay, okay.
He made a trip to Bangkok without knowing anybody, didn't know where he was going.
Yeah.
But on the train, he met one lady whose children were in the boarding school.
In Bangkok?
In Penang, in the Light Street Convent boarding school.
Okay.
And they started talking, and this lady was very nice, asked him, who are you going to see in Bangkok? My godfather and his wife were staying in Bangkok.
Okay.
So he says, I'm going to see so and so. I says, I know him. Oh. This lady says, well, see what a small world it was. I know him. So and she asked him, is he going to meet you at the railway station? Well, that's the arrangement, but I don't know which end of the railway station
right,
or where.
Yeah.
So when they arrived, and my godfather was there. So they met, and this lady and knew my godfather because they're talking and all that, and they got to know each other, and this lady helped her a lot finding out more information about hotel arrangements and tour places to visit.
How opportune.
That's right. So, you know, things work out the way they would. So he went and he looked, of course he had to go and look around and see what are the tourist attractions, accommodations, and he learned the trade, on his own.
Yeah.
No training of any sort.
Yeah.
You know, unlike now where, of course now it's different because now it's so competitive. It's so competitive. So he did all on his own. Of course, there were a lot of teething problems. And I still remember that the very first tour he took was a group of quite a few teachers, and then I think my mother went also. That was in 1960, 59 or 60, I'm not sure now, must be around that time. And of course he had to go through a lot of teething problems. And the group that went were a very mature group of people, so they were also very cooperative. So it worked well. And he carried on that tourist business. When did he start? 1960? He stopped this business, and then from there, when he was more familiar with the place and he could arrange different packages, the Aussies who were here were his best customers, his best clients. Mm. Yeah? He used to conduct tours very often.
Yeah.
By train, by bus, by coach, you know. All the way by coach from Butterworth.
Yeah.
Along the way, they would make other stops, you know, so that they could see more of Thailand.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Mm.
And up to Bangkok, no? And then from Bangkok to Chiang Mai. I went on one of the trips at the end of 1960, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, after I finished, that time it was called Senior Cambridge, Form 5. Huh? Went on one of his trips all the way up to Chiang Mai.
Wow.
He stopped in Bangkok, toured Bangkok, then went up to Chiang Mai for a few days. You know? At that time, Chiang Mai was just a small little village type town, you know? But it was good at that time because I would say everything was more pristine.
Mm.
Yeah, more of its natural, traditional and natural state the way it was.
Mm.
Now it's like it's becoming very, what's the word for it? Where stereotype, commercialized.
Commercialized,
So. That was his trade, his business then.
What got him interested in it? He just wanted to change.
He had to find a source of income.
Yeah.
You see, he was doing it at first. He had two other partners. It didn't work out because of personality clashes, I guess. And that was more for like local tours. At that time, tourism was just very, very infant stage. Yeah. Very, very infant stage, you know?
Yeah.
Very few people. Singapore was doing well.
Yeah.
He had, from there, after he met these people in Singapore, he got the idea of, what was the name of that company? I think it was called, no, I better not mention because I'm not sure.
Some tour company in Singapore.
Yeah, some tour company in Singapore. And he got the idea from there. He found that, this is what I want to do. And that's how he saw most of Bangkok and Thailand and traveled more.
Did he do tours in Malaysia?
Not within Malaysia,
okay.
No. It was the Singapore tours, after a while, he stopped because there were more competitors already, you know. Then he concentrated on Bangkok and Chiang Mai. Yeah? And then he after the Aussies gradually moved out, he sort of slowed down, and then he just didn't do it at all. He was also, well, it wasn't that old, he could have, but he found it difficult to manage, and it was too competitive already by then, you see. That was in the, that would have been in the late 70s, late 70s already. So all in all, I think his travel business, he did it in for about, let's say 15 years now, 15 years or more, about that. And then, of course, that went into retirement. Too early a retirement, but that was his choice.
How long were you guys in Upper Penang Road?
We lived, we lived in Upper Penang Road. Let me see now. 20 odd years. 20 odd years. We lived in Penang, at that house in Penang Road. Now 25 years. Ah yes, that's right. It must have been, it must have been more than, yeah, about 25 years. 25.
I'm sure a lot changed in your time there, the area around it.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
What were some changes that you saw?
Now see.
Well, I guess from when you're, even when you're still living there. Were there a lot of changes, or is
the changes? And when we were living there, the changes that came up was that field I was telling you about, where all the children used to play. That was cleared, and the road, there was a road through. Because last time you could come in, let's say if you come in from Farquhar Street, you, and then where City Bayview is now, City Bayview was not there. City Bayview was where the Padang was, that big field was. City Bayview and the traffic lights and Hotel Continental.
That was just the Padang.
Huge Padang, a very big. Uncle Ling used to walk through that to go to school. And then on the way, he and his friends would stop and play marbles there. So that was, that was not in existence. And then in the 60s, 50s and 60s, gradually all this was cleared. Then Hotel Continental. Hotel Continental came up in about, must have been 66 or so. I'm not, I can't remember those dates. But I, all I remember is when my daughter was born, Hotel Continental was already there. You know? And then that road through was already there. And then the houses in front, many of the people, many of the tenants had moved out. And then this, now that was later on, sorry. In the 60s, there were still many, 60s, 70s, they're still there. It was in the 80s that they started to slowly move out. And then these, is after that, is what you see now. A lot, lots of changes. City Bayview came up. There was a next ENO. ENO was renovated, extended. ENO was not, it was just one small area. That also has extended. And then CityTel came up. So big, a lot of changes there. You know, if you haven't been to Penang for the last, I'd say, 30 years, 35 years, and you came now, suddenly you find a big, 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 you won't recognize, you won't know, just like any other city, just like any other town, everything's different.
The schools you went to were nearby?
Yes, we went to Convent Light Street, so all the
just
children around
distance.
There, all the children around there would go to, the girls went to the Convent Light Street, the boys went to St. Xavier's. So, like I said, they used to walk through the Padang, very happily, you know, and then we used to take main road to the Convent Light Street, and
would you say most of the people around there were Catholic as well?
Because
those schools are Catholic, right?
Yes, but then they took it anybody.
Of course,
anybody. But there were quite a few Catholic families, but the most of the Catholic families were living around the church area, around the Assumption Church area. We, I think, in our it's actually not very far. I think we were the only Catholic. Oh, no, no, sorry. Opposite, there was another Catholic family. And only two Catholic families.
Would you say most of your friends weren't Catholic or were Catholic
growing
up?
No, we mixed. You know, at that time, you don't, no difference in color or creed.
Yeah.
We all were one. We played together, we fought together, we cried together, we laughed together.
Yeah.
We grew up together like that, you know? And till today, many of us keep in touch with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, some have passed away, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a good, I would say, the 20 years that my siblings and I lived in Penang Road were the happiest childhood days.
Yeah, yeah.
Were the most fun days.
Yeah.
Which I feel many children are deprived of today.
Just the openness is not
there. Yeah, yeah. It's the space, the actual physical space we had, how we invented our own games.
Yeah.
I remember my parents couldn't afford to give us pocket money to buy toys and all. We made our own marbles.
Out of what?
The clay that was, you know, actually where we lived, the back of the house was actually a carpentry shop.
Okay.
A carpenter's, a furniture shop. Shop making furniture. Yeah. And so they would burn the wood shavings, you know, in this big ground. And then the earth would become hot and
hard.
And then the soil was at clay.
Yeah.
So we used to go and dig that, mold them into a
balls
into and then leave it after the fire to fire it. And then we harden. And that was, and we played search in the sand for beads.
Yeah.
You know? And the boys used to come over to play top. And that's why my sister, my third sister, she's very good till now.
Uh-huh.
You know, the top where you spin the thread and she can hit it and she can spin it. That's how we had all those games.
Yeah.
We invented our own game. We played hopscotch. We played this, what we call kalitoy.
What's kalitoy?
Where, you know, it's like a defensive, you have two teams playing.
Okay.
So I think it was like three, one in front, guarding your area.
Okay.
Yeah. One would stand in front, we would draw a square, a section. And then, touch you with the other opposing team, off he goes. I touch your hand, you touch mine, clap. Then you have to prevent them from getting into your space.
Oh, but physically with your body?
Body. Then, very, we call it kalitoy.
Yeah.
So if anybody who hears it and knows about it. You know. So all those games we had. And then kite season was the best. All the boys will be flying at the kites in that big padang.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember one occasion.
You make your own kites.
Some did. They used the glass.
Yeah.
Glass and make the glass thread.
Crush the grill. My father told me he did that.
Ah, yes. Your father would know more of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I remember one occasion. And then they would fight.
Yeah.
And then try to
cut the kite.
I remember one day that this one kite was cut and loose and it was floating all the way. And guess what? It floated into our compound. And you had all the boys chasing it. I ran, I closed the big gate, and I got the kite. It was so funny. That one was so funny. I mean, I didn't know how to fly.
Yeah.
Just the thrill of it. You know, these are things that children should enjoy.
Yeah.
Should enjoy. You know?
Yeah.
So those were childhood days. But coming back to the Filipino community, like I said, there are not many of us. Now, I'm up, especially the younger ones, they're not, I should say, in touch with the older, what happened before. Maybe there are some who might be, I don't know, you might find somebody, you know. But among the older ones, I think there are very few Filipinos left, you know, here in Penang.
So growing up, like in that little compound you're talking about, what was the ethnic background of most of the children?
Chinese. We were the only Filipino family there. Indian family.
Yeah.
Indians. Sikhs.
Uh-huh.
You know, we were those were staying upstairs out where we were staying. But majority Chinese.
Okay.
That was the main
You called yourself the Filipino family? Is that how you identify growing up?
No, really. Actually, we were, maybe we were too young and we were all together. We never really looked at, that Indian family or this Chinese family. We were just friends. We called each other by names.
Yeah, yeah.
We just called each other by names, you know?
And how did other people identify you? Do you remember?
I don't... There was no distinct thing that said, oh, that particular.
Yeah.
No, it was, everything was by name. We knew each other by names.
Yeah.
Yeah? And some even by pet names.
Yeah.
So there was no such thing as, are you that?
Yeah.
No, there's no barrier, I would say.
So the other Filipino people who did end up staying in Penang, everyone was just scattered around?
Like I said, they were, many, the ones I knew of were staying in Transfer Road. And
did they end up having families? Or?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes. Oh, they are, have grandchildren, great-grandchildren who are now around here in Penang also. And that's why I said earlier that they asked me whether I wanted to be in that.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't think I have much to contribute then, at that time. So they have all moved up from there now. They're doing very well, many of them. You know. It's just that it's a pity because of the small number of Filipinos, we do not have either an association or a club or whereby we can meet and then sort of be in touch with our roots. We don't have that.
If you could guess, how many Filipino descendants do you think are here in
Statistics, I wouldn't know. I have no idea at all.
Of your personal circles?
Let me see. The few Eurasian, the few Filipinos families, I would know. Me. Maybe a handful only.
Yeah, like five or less than
10. Yeah, less than 10. Less than 10. Because we never had the opportunity, we're never exposed to each other because of living in different areas, distance and so on.
Did you feel like you grew up more Chinese then?
Yeah, definitely. Grew up. And which actually, I do feel that I have lost a lot of my father's heritage because he did, because the thing is, he was here alone.
Yeah.
His sisters
had gone back.
So if the sisters had stayed back and we had, you know, like a bigger family, a bigger community, then we would know more of our roots.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because my father was alone and he did mix around with the other Filipinos, but mainly the men, and they would have their own kind of topics of conversation.
Yeah.
And then we were not exposed. We were not even in their presence to hear or pick up the language.
Yeah.
And that's why we could not, maybe don't speak the language.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, language is not something you sit down and read from a book. Yeah. You've got to speak it.
Yeah.
Because like I said, in that little that playground where we, in Penang Road, there's Big Padang, the Indians could speak Hokkien, the Hokkien could speak Tamil, and the Sikhs could speak Chinese, and we would pick up a few Sikh words, and we all one big happy family.
Yeah.
You know? So, and we communicated well. But unfortunately, we were the only Filipinos who had no one to converse with.
Yeah. At home, what did you guys speak?
English. Mainly English. And Hokkien, of course. Yeah. My father understood. Of course, he could. But he never really spoke a lot of Hokkien. So, until he died, I tell you, he could not speak Hokkien like a Hokkien. He still had that sing-song Filipino accent, you know. He would understand, but he could not express himself except for a few words. He could not like make a proper sentence in Hokkien, converse in Hokkien. He just, and but it's nice to hear the way they speak. You know? You can tell straight away. He still, after he died at 87. When he spoke certain words, he still had that strong Filipino accent. For example, the word asparagus. He would say the word asparagus. He will not say asparagus, he would say asparagus. many words, you know, the typical, with the typical Filipino accent in it.
Yeah.
But it was good, it was nice. What was another word that you would say, so my grandchildren would say, oh, Kong Kong always talks like that. What's it, the name? Elizabeth. Elizabeth, yeah. Elizabeth, the name Elizabeth, yeah. You know? He was Elizabeth.
Yeah,
you know that.
Yeah.
So these are little things which I cherish a lot. Yeah. When I think about it, I cherish a lot because it's already gone.
Yeah.
And I was part of it, part of that time.
So. Yeah. What was your mother's family like? I know you mentioned
there was plenty to tell about my mother's family. My mother's family had, they were five girls and two boys.
Mm-hmm.
She was the youngest
girl. Yeah.
And she just passed away in 2009 at the age of 89.
Mm.
And when they were young, she was very privileged. And she used to tell us, especially about Chinese New Year. She said, you know, when I was young, we had one new dress for every day of Chinese
New
Year. 15 days of Chinese New Year.
Yeah.
One new dress a day, and then they would ride in a rickshaw, a high thing, and then on the 15th Chak Gor Man, they would go to Esplanade, and that was the time when when people wanted to matchmake. They were always at that time marriages were matchmake, where the guys would be able to have a look at the girls. Then they would go in their Sunday best, and all their finery, and parade in their rickshaw there, up and down Esplanade. And then my grandmother was a very good cook.
Mm-hmm.
She was the matriarchal type, and every day her job was going to play chiki.
Mm-hmm.
Play chiki, so my mother would accompany her. And then the other sisters, the older ones, they each had a chore at home. Only my mother was the only one who didn't. Yeah, but later on, of course, she had it hard, difficult. But when they were young, and I remember that one thing, like I said, those who could afford, the more wealthy ones, when they ordered jewelry, the jeweler, the goldsmith, would come to the house. I think this is something very common. Any Hokkien person in Penang listening to this, to them, it's nothing new. The goldsmith would come and the customer would choose the pattern, the stones or whatever, and they would be there actually manufacturing the thing, literally custom made in front of the customer. And I remember that because I must have been about 5 years old or so.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being there, seeing all this,
these
things happening, and how my grandmother was. She had this, the way they all just Nyonya Sal, and the house that they lived in, that this huge altar.
Uh-huh.
I used to be so scared of that altar. Every time I went to that house in Abu City Lane, once the front door is open, I close my eyes and run right in. I was scared to look at the altar. So those are that incident about the goldsmith I remember very well.
Yeah.
I do remember my mother's father.
Uh-huh.
He used to wear, at that time it was I think the men used to dress like that, it's white suits, stiff cotton suits, and then white shoes with a cocked hat, and whenever I went there, he would put me on his knees. I suppose because at that time, I think if I'm not mistaken, I was the only grandchild around. One lot of cousins had gone to KL, so. And we were staying, that time I was already staying, we were staying in Penang Road.
Yeah.
And he used to take a trishaw from Abu City Lane to Penang Road. Come in, sit down 2 minutes, take the trishaw back. But perhaps they all at that time, things like Alzheimer's or any other disease was not something that they talked about or were aware of. So perhaps he may have suffered from some kind of dementia, which the family were not aware of, because he used to do that.
Like he wouldn't remember? Why did he
wouldn't remember.
Stay so short a time.
Yeah, and then he would go back to Abu City Lane. A few minutes later, he'd take the trishaw and come back to my place again. So probably he have some kind of... By then, by that time also, they had lost a lot of their property and money and jewelry after the war.
Yeah. Did you mention they were Nanya, or did I not hear?
Yes, they were.
Oh,
they
your
were.
Mother's family is Nanya.
Nanya. My grandmother spoke a Hokkien, which I found rather. I think it's at that Straits Hokkien. Mm. So it not. I don't know whether it was called Hakka. I'm not sure now. Yeah. Maybe somebody else can verify this. The way she spoke.
Yeah.
There are words now I can still in my mind. I remember her saying, but the tone.
It was different than Penang Hokkien.
It was different from Penang's Hokkien, Penang people's Hokkien, I think. They're Straits Hokkien.
Yeah.
From the people, and most of the people who came from Fujian province in China. In fact, the people, this is what I also found out when we went to the Philippines 2 years ago, that a lot of the Chinese in Philippines, the old ones are those who have built
mansions,
who are now millionaires and all. They went there as very, very poor people, and they all came from the Fujian province. Mm. Okay? So, my great-grandfather also came from there. And they came at the time when they had the pigtail. Was it the Manchu time or something? My great-grandfather had that, you see. And that's how they built up their property. But then came down to my grandfather. Now, when on my grandfather's side, the lineage, this is where we are not clear.
Yeah.
Only this cousin of mine, who is now 84, she's the only one who knows a little bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
From what I gather from her is, my great-grandfather had four wives.
Okay.
And the only children of his we know of were my grandfather and his twin.
Okay.
He had a twin and one elder brother.
And which wife was?
They were from the first wife. That's all we know. So,
these relatives you don't know about.
We have no idea of. Is it? So, they were very rich. They own all the houses in this road that is now named after him. But, well, through their vices, they lost.
Yeah.
Bit by bit, you know? And, so when it came down to the children, they didn't inherit anything already.
Yeah.
Even though my grandmother held the purse strings. Otherwise, my grandfather would have just blown everything. Otherwise, during the Japanese occupation also, they would have suffered.
Yeah. Did they suffer much during the
I guess they did, because where food was concerned and all that.
Yeah.
And they used, not physically, like they didn't, except for bag of food and all that. So my mother's family is like that. She had five girls, you know. One married and went to Thailand. The second auntie died very young also. Third auntie died later. That one, I wasn't in Penang, married and left Penang. So I didn't know much of what was happening then.
Yeah?
I still keep in touch with the cousins, my cousins, we still do, because we are the only few left. Not that many.
What did your grandfather's business? What was his business?
I had no idea. I had no idea what he was doing. He must have inherited his father's business, wealth and whatever business they were doing. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
All I know, what my mother told me was that he owned this row of houses, two rows of houses along the whole road, and that's why that road was named after him. And then that they spent
only because he owned the houses.
Yes, and then
that street's in Georgetown.
It's in Georgetown. Yeah, and then
do you know the name?
I think I don't know that.
Okay,
and then anyway, and I suppose the sons. I don't know what they did with the money.
Yeah.
They gambled it away. But from what I understand, it was not my grandfather, my mother's father, who gambled most of the money. It was the elder son.
Mm.
Yeah, that's what I've been told. You know, I can't verify that. It's just that's what
it's
all. And my cousin, the 84-year-old cousin now, she tells me that there's my great-grandfather's tomb is somewhere in some cemetery. She has seen it. And there are the tombstones of the three wives, but the fourth wife's tomb is somewhere else. they were not buried near each other.
Yeah.
Only their three wives. Very interesting.
Yeah, I didn't know your part in Anya.
Yeah, my grandmother, what she wore and all that.
Only your grandmother was Nanya, not your grandfather. He wasn't.
No, my grandfather, I guess he was
Hokkien.
I wonder what would he call him. His father came from China.
Yeah.
Fujian, China.
Yeah.
So what would they be?
Yeah.
You know? But my grandmother, so that's one word she always used to say that struck me when I was a kid. Like you said, you know, when in Hokkien you say Nulang, that means you all or you. She said Unang. So
yeah.
Today I remember that word.
Yeah.
Because when she would refer to it, she would say, hey, you all, you kids, Unang.
Yeah.
So I used to ask my mother, she said, like, no, straight Hokkien. I see. But other than that,
Her family was in Penang. Your grandmother's family was in Penang.
Yes, they were Penang. Actually, she had a lot of family. But I do not know about her siblings or her father.
Yeah.
Not. I only know about her and her cousins.
Yeah.
You know? I do keep in touch with her. In fact, there's one cousin. My first cousins. My mother's first cousin. My mother's first cousin's children.
Mm-hmm.
She's staying in the next block. You know?
Oh, wow.
And actually, the thing is, she and I look so much alike.
Ah.
And she and I and my cousin, who's 84 years old, we three of us look so much like my maternal grandmother. And I looked at her and I said, hey, you know, Anzi, we look so much.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the genes are strong.
Yeah, yeah. How are you feeling?
Huh?
You okay?
I'm fine. Okay. Anything?
Oh.
Within the Filipino community, yes, there was social status differences.
Yeah.
Not very much, not very wide.
Yeah.
Not very wide, you know? Because they must have accepted the fact that they all came on the same boat with the same nothing.
Yeah.
You know? We came in nothing, no riches or no extra talents or anything. We came all same level playing field, I would say. Huh?
Yeah.
But it is the local people. It's some of the local people who sort of look down on them because they just consider them musicians and boxers.
Yeah.
You professionally, you are like nothing.
Yeah.
You know, you. But then I would say they contributed a lot to the community.
Oh, of course, yeah.
You see, boxing was a sport that was enjoyed by people. They provided.
And most of the boxers were Filipino.
At that time, as far as I remember and know of, you know, I've been told that many of them were Filipinos.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And it was a sport.
Yeah.
It was, I would even say it was professional. You can't just go in and box anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But they would be called professionals.
Yeah.
You know, just like the professionals of this. It's just that at that time, it was not a money-making sport.
There wasn't much betting?
No, I don't know about the betting.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There wasn't much... it wasn't like a business or the way it is now.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't much on these things. And the poor boxers, it was more like the... What do you call it? The rice bowl. You see, they did it because it was a source of income.
Yeah.
But I feel that they did contribute something to society because they gave the people, the society, a sport.
Mm-hmm.
A sport at that time, you know, that people could enjoy.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though it were, and especially so for those even less fortunate, the very, very low income, who could go and watch at that time, the boxing was held at Great World Park, New World Park and Great World Park. And those who had seats paid for them, and outside of them, those who were standing far away, they still enjoy it for free. So I felt that they did contribute to society.
Of course.
And musicians, definitely.
Do you remember going to any boxing matches?
I think I did. I'm not sure. But I think because at that time, New World Park was an entertainment park, amusement park.
Okay.
So my father used to take us to go on the carousel, on the Ferris wheel and all that. And I do remember not really sitting and witnessing the whole match, but seeing a boxing session on. You know, a boxing match going on, is it?
Yeah.
But not really witnessing it.
Yeah.
And I was too young. I wasn't interested in the sport. Yeah, yeah. So I wouldn't know the names of the people involved. And so.
Do you remember when it started becoming a less popular sport?
I can't remember. I guess it must have slowly waned off.
Yeah.
Maybe in the 50s.
Yeah. And then those boxers went back home to the Philippines.
No, I don't know what they. Maybe they switched to something more lucrative.
Right. Yeah.
And then it wasn't in demand, you know. Yeah. And the Great Wall Park also gradually lost its attraction, and something different came up.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Great Wall Park was a great amusement park, just like what you have, but more not so much of this digital and there's electrical and electrical. We had those dodgem cars. We had the carousel.
Yeah.
We had the Ferris wheel. What else did we have? And all those games where you shoot the duck down and so on. All that was there. And there was candy floss being sold. Kacang, steamed kacang being sold. All that there at Great World Park and World Park.
Yeah.
So that was the entertainment for the people there.
Yeah.
Now you don't get this. All you go to do is
the
go to the malls. Into an aircon area and you spend money.
Yeah.
There you get free entertainment at that time. And then they had this Ronggeng girls.
Uh-huh.
That's very interesting.
Tell me about that.
They would have a stage and there were women who would dance partners, you call them the Ronggeng girls. And at the time it was called the Ronggeng with the dance. And men would buy tickets, pick a partner, and they dance the wrong game with them. One, I don't know how much it costs, all I know is. And you could see it.
Yeah.
I mean, you could just stand outside and watch the people dancing all for free.
Yeah.
So at that time, entertainment was in these parks and all. Even the man with not a cent could enjoy it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We did have to pay an entrance fee into the park.
I
can't remember, a few cents. Only.
But not that much.
Just to go into the park to enjoy all that.
Yeah,
all those things. So you had that, and then besides the games, quite a lot. So some I don't really remember anymore. Yeah, but that was the entertainment world for us then.
Yeah.
And then coming back to what I said about...
You were going to talk about the musicians.
The musicians... I feel that just like the Eurasians in Penang, they really contributed a lot to music in Penang. The history of it and the popularity, you know, and that's why.
Are you talking about the descendants from like the Portuguese?
Yes, the Portuguese, you know. They're all musically minded and musically gifted.
Mm-hmm.
The Filipinos definitely are. So at that time, I feel. They were the ones, the Filipinos were the ones who played at weddings, at funerals, you know. They were choir, church singers, choir people. Yeah. And
there were quite a few bands, right?
And they actually, at that time, I'm not sure about big bands because I was too young to understand.
Or small singing groups.
They had small singing groups.
Yeah.
And then they would play at weddings, at funerals, Chinese funerals especially.
Yeah.
And then... any other occasion, you know, but I feel that they contributed, no doubt, in a very small way, but they enlivened the social scene, like you say, with their music. There was these two places in Penang, which is now where Hotel City Bayview is.
Okay.
There were two cabarets there. At that time, cabarets were very popular. Piccadilly and City Lights, you know, And if I'm not mistaken, there were some Filipinos, maybe not a full band, mm-hmm. but many played there.
Yeah.
City Lights and Piccadilly. And then when we were kids,
yeah.
we stayed around the corner at the big house. We would go there and we'd stand outside and watch like, all these lady people dancing. Yeah, we could go in.
Yeah.
So you'd watch all these ladies dancing.
Yeah.
And that was, for us, we enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It was a form of recreation. It was a form of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that those people, those musicians, whoever they were, they contributed to society.
Yeah. Were there other Filipino individuals or families who also intermarried local people, like your family?
Oh, yes, yes. Many of them.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know who they married, but...
Right.
Because when they came, whether or not... If they came with families, it was a different story.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And then their children, you know, especially that if you see the names of some of the people around, very Filipino names, mm-hmm. you know? So, they met their parents must have intermarried with local people. Because there were no other many Filipinos for them to intermarry. So they intermarried. Yeah.
You mentioned your childhood was very idyllic and wonderful times. Were there any hard times?
Oh yes, of course.
What were some of the hard times?
We were young.
Yeah.
And when you're young, you're oblivious to these things. Every day is a happy day.
Yeah.
Every day is a happy, cheerful day. Then the worry was on the parents.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They were not like, for example, during the Japanese time. If those who went through the Japanese time, those who are maybe in their teens, they would say they went through those hard times. But for us, it was just every day, welcome. Big family, six of us, we fought. Children, you know.
Yeah.
You fight, you make up, and then the mother is there, they're trying to sort the thing better out, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Other than that, no real crisis, I would say. No real big crisis, you know, that I would say was traumatic or anything.
Yeah.
Like Maybe for others, I'm not sure, but for me, it was okay. I wouldn't say it was plain sailing, but...
Yeah.
There were ups and downs, ups and downs. But generally, considering the childhood of it, the playing part, the playtime part, that was good.
Mm.
That was good. Never had many good friends and all that.
Did your parents have, how was it, I guess because they're from two very different cultures, how was, in your observations, did their cultural differences, did that cause any difficulties?
No. Actually, my father adapted very well to the local culture.
Yeah.
Because I guess also the reason being, he was the only one left behind.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have his own family members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And which I think, I do feel that we miss out a lot on that.
Yeah.
If his, like I said earlier, his sisters had been here, then we would, for example, learn the language.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe now be able to speak Tagalog well enough.
Yeah.
With all my other cousins.
Yeah.
You know, when they left, I was still too young to pick up anything.
Yeah.
You know? The one language for one thing. And then food.
Mm.
You know, the different types of food. My mother picked up some dishes.
Mm-hmm.
But not enough to listen. Festivals.
Mm.
What they would celebrate when they were young.
Mm-hmm.
They would have celebrated when they were young. Certain feast days, maybe Saints feast days, or just community occasions. And then clothing, traditional clothes. I know I have there's a picture of me. I don't know, the other day I was arranging the albums, I'm not sure now. The costume, the Filipino costume, you know? There's one of me when I was, I think, 5 years old, wearing that Filipino costume. So we don't have, we have not been able to practice more of our identity. You know? If we were more, we are more Hokkien, we're more Penang, we're more Chinese than we are Filipino.
Was there a lot of strong, I guess, like, did your family consider themselves really Malaysian, or was it like, oh, we're just like Penangites?
We just consider ourselves Penangites.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, there wasn't that strong Malaysian identity yet.
There's
a lot more propaganda, I feel like, in maybe nowadays.
We Well, at that time, the concept of being a Malaysian, or that even like for me especially, even well up to Aling,
yeah.
We were Malayans, yeah. Then, mm-hmm. Until no Malayans,
yeah.
Up to Malaysians is after 63.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were just Malayans, yeah. But we were the concept of it was not there.
Yeah.
We were just either Chinese, yeah. Mm-hmm. Penang Chinese, mm-hmm. Penangites, yeah. Kuala Lumpur people, yeah. This yeah. Some Singapore people, yeah. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Not cohesive.
Yeah. Yeah.
I won't say that we were like segregated, but it's yeah. Just that we just grew into that kind
right.
Of a society.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're just Penang Hokkiens.
Yeah.
If like Penang people, whenever they went to KL,
yeah.
They had difficulty
talking.
Understanding the
yeah.
Cantonese.
Yeah.
Because people in Ipoh, KL spoke more Cantonese.
Yeah.
And Penang Hokkiens seemed to sound very rough to the Cantonese. Mm-hmm. You know, Cantonese is yes. Very sing-song
yeah.
And more delicate, the yeah. Way they speak, more refined.
Yeah.
Penang Hokkien is this Fujian Hokkien.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of words there, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The vocabulary is very, very more Chinese.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Chinese.
Yeah.
So, but when people used to ask us, what race are you? Of course, I'll say Filipino straight away.
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Filipino. Mm-hmm. Until now.
Mm.
When it comes to race, I'll say Filipino.
Mm. Is there a reason why you leave
no,
off
just,
that?
Huh?
Is there a reason you don't say you're also Hokkien?
Then, as we grew older, when we had to fill in forms yeah. And all, we just ask for one, so you say Filipino.
Oh, there was
but
only
I
one.
I would say Filipino Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Filipino Chinese.
Yeah.
And you know the expression, when you're Filipino and Chinese, you're a Chilipino.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you said that's what we are Chilipinos. So my children also will be Filipinos.
Yeah, yeah. Do you remember what it was like living under British rule? Like, how did their presence affect your livelihood?
The most livelihood.
Or just...
anything. Yeah. Education.
Yeah.
It made a very big difference in the education. We spoke good English.
Yeah.
We had good English teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say only English. We had all the teachers who all spoke good English,
mm-hmm.
Whatever subject was taught.
Yeah.
You know? And education, standard of education was high.
Mm-hmm.
It was, education was not something that you did as a formality. It was your future.
Yeah.
You decided your future. And it was very important. That is the most important thing that
yeah.
The influence of
yeah.
The British at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah? And everybody want at that time everybody every child
yeah.
Who if given a chance had the money and the talent and the brains would want to go to England.
Yeah.
I mean because we all just mm-hmm. Knew the English and the Irish nuns who
mm-hmm.
Came.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spoke very good English.
Mm-hmm.
But the strange thing is this, mm-hmm. You know, they came and they brought their culture, they passed it on to us, and it spread in our society and
yeah.
All that. But their own people at home, they were not exposed to what we were in other countries, how their influence had touched us and how we have now, we are not people living up in trees anymore, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
You know? So, there's... their influence, I feel, the most important thing was in education.
Mm-hmm.
To me,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
To me,
yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
I was too young
yeah.
Then to analyze
yeah.
To really understand.
Yeah.
To me, that they brought us good education.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's all.
Yeah, because from the British rule and then the emergency, before Malaya became
Malaysia,
right? You were maybe. You're coming of age then, right?
Oh yes, the time
yeah.
I was already married. I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah.
But I think many of us were not, I do not know about other people, but maybe many of us were not, there was an emergency, but to many of us, I think the average person, it didn't, nothing significant, as in,
It didn't seem that different?
It didn't seem that different. Mm-hmm. It was, as long as, I guess maybe we are, as long as we had food to eat, a roof over our heads, you know,
and
maybe people who were at that time more politically inclined, or those who were more concerned about all this political, social, and economic thing, they would understand better.
Yeah.
But for the ordinary man in the street, it was just...
So you weren't really aware of any like anti-British movements or...
No. I wouldn't know all that. I wouldn't, wouldn't have no idea.
After you... You went to Convent Light, right?
Convent Light Street.
And you also ended up teaching there?
Yes. No, I, yes.
Yeah.
I went to the Convent Teachers College in Kuala Lumpur.
Okay.
It was a private college run by the HIJ nuns.
Okay.
That college was only in existence for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it had to be closed. But I'm very proud to say that I'm a product of that college. Because... we were trained and then we went, most of us went back to the schools that we came from. That was a good thing.
Yeah.
So we had our choice of our school to teach in. Some of us were bound by contract, some were not. You know, those who were sponsored by the school, you come back, you serve that school for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
And so I went back to CLS for 2 years. So I was very happy there. I mean, I gone to school there for 11 years, came back and taught there for 2 years.
What got you into teaching?
Hmm?
What got you interested in teaching?
You know, at that's an interesting thing there. At the time, people of my generation, to the average, what shall I say, the average class, the middle class, middle class, whose parents maybe were government servants, or worked as clerks,
owners.
Not business people, clerks and so on. I won't say wage earners, but then wage earners sounds so, not a nice word. But earning a salary, but they're not rich, they're not poor.
Mm-hmm.
It's just middle. Those of us, the children in that category, we either turn to teaching, nursing, secretarial jobs.
And this is, are you speaking, is this a gendered occupation too?
No.
Anyone?
Either, male and female.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of male nurses.
Mm-hmm.
Many males went into male nursing.
Yeah.
It was very popular.
Yeah.
And from there, you know, after their nursing, they specialized in to becoming radiographers and so on, those who could afford later. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, those who could afford, they were more professional, like they were lawyers, doctors, dentists, accountants, and so on. But the middle class, the opportunities for us was either you be a go into nursing, teaching, secretarial work.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, in the 50s, 60s, a girl, a female, you wouldn't even dare say you want to work in a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
People would get the wrong impression.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there were very few hotels anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that not the way it is now.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to be a what do you call them? What is it?
In the hotel.
PR line going like my daughter did. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
Going become PR or a secretary or going to marketing or sales and all.
Yeah.
No, that at that time no such thing. Hotels were not. Singapore, I think, was more advanced in that. We in Penang also we were a little bit. Penang is a little bit more. How should I? They're not. We are not. We are not backward, but we are more conservative.
Small, okay. Uh-huh.
People more conservative. You know, more conservative.
Small town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So professionally, like, what you ask, all those were the job opportunities, and also because when we went into nursing.
Yeah.
Or teaching those who went to the government colleges, like MTC.
Uh-huh.
It was a load off the parents because they received allowances.
Mm.
Really? Like the nurses, Now the nurses, those who want to go into nursing, they have to pay thousands to train as a nurse.
Yeah, schooling is expensive.
Then they were inviting us to be, welcoming. And then they had allowances of $100 a month, which was very good for the parents. And in fact, some of these who joined these professions, they were helping the parents with what allowances they were getting. I went to this private college, private college, but not those where we paid large sums of money.
Yeah.
Couldn't have afforded to go.
Yeah.
The nuns were doing more, it was more to promote education more than anything, promote teachers, train good teachers than anything. So we paid like what? I think we had to pay some tuition fees, but I can't remember how much now.
But you do remember it wasn't like totally exorbitant.
If I'm not mistaken, it was only 200 for the year. Because I borrowed from the school, that the
Cornwall Lights. 200 ringgit a year.
200 ringgit for the year, tuition fees.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. So 2 years, it was 400. And because when I came back to start teaching in the Light Street Convent, I had to pay back my debt.
Yeah.
And I only paid $20 a month. You see, so how generous they were, So, and then we had to pay our own board. That was only for board and lodging, 40 ringgit a month.
Wow.
You can't even survive a day with 40 ringgit especially
not
in KL.
Yeah.
So that was the opportunities for us. And the college I was in was run by the HIJ nuns, that's it.
Yeah.
And we had a few outside lecturers for different subjects, but the principals were the nuns.
Mm-hmm.
And very strict, schedule, strict day. We started at 8, I think, each day. We had to be up by 6:30 and then go down for breakfast.
Yeah.
Like a boarding school to
go for
breakfast, come back, do your little chores.
Yeah.
And then lecture start at 8. Certain days, except for lunch break and tea break, it was right up to 6:45. Certain days, depending on the subjects we took. But we were so well trained. It was an all-round training. Not just to become intellectual, it is character training.
Mm-hmm.
It was character training also, and all the values, the real moral values. So when we went out after our training and we went back to our schools, some went into government schools. And those who went to government schools always had this compliment. After a few months, the principal will know where the teacher came from. But the other members of the staff will say, "Were you trained in the convent?" And then the teacher's concerned will say, "Why do you ask?" "Well, you're different from the other teachers. You're different from the other trainees who come and those who have been trained."
Yeah.
So, because we had no choice, we had to follow the rules.
Yeah.
Otherwise, out you go or you fail. And standard was high.
We
used to compare our schedule with the NTC students in KL, and they say, "What? You have lectures the whole day?" And they depending on their subjects. Certain days they had nothing on, certain days they had 3 hours of lecture and that's it. We will have the whole shebang, up to evening.
Yeah.
Very
yeah.
strict schedule. And we were not allowed to go gallivanting every day.
Yeah.
Each time, if we wanted to go out for what we call late pass, latest 10 p.m.
There's a curfew.
Curfew.
Yeah.
10 p.m. definitely. Yeah. And we had to sign in and all that the nuns were responsible to our parents for us.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I went there because a lot of training, there's a training ground.
Mm-hmm.
Then when we went into college, how old was I? 19.
Mm.
So that's the time when you're vulnerable to all these outside influences.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where you need to be put on the right road, the right track. So that was a good thing. But unfortunately, they closed down the college after 10 years.
Do you know why?
Well, that is not for me to say. It's more of a...
It was something internal.
No, it wasn't. It's educational policy thing.
Yeah. Because I know nowadays with Malaysian policy, you can't really start religious schools.
It was not a religious school. It was a teacher's training college.
But it was convent, led by nuns.
Run by the convent.
Okay, so but it wasn't considered a religious
It was teaching. Not. It was not okay. religious. It was not a religious college at all. Mm. It was a proper, the syllabus, the whatever we did,
yeah.
was according to what was the other colleges were also.
Okay.
Studying.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a proper teacher's standard, training college.
Yeah.
Same standard.
Yeah.
You know, and our certificates, also came from whatever mm-hmm. authorities that mm-hmm. issued the mm-hmm. certificates mm-hmm. to. It was there's a word for it. A regular teacher.
Yeah, yeah,
student.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
not
same
nothing,
standard, yeah.
No, not anything religious. It's just that it was run by the convent
yeah.
nuns.
Okay.
The
I see.
Nuns.
Yeah. Mm. So you were 20 when you started teaching at Convent Light? 21?
Mm,
How, your
20,
program was
20.
1 year?
2 years.
2 years, okay.
2 years.
Yeah.
20.
Wow.
I was 20.
You were young.
Yeah. Young and at that time at that time most of us around that age were very like we conform to certain norms and
mm-hmm.
not like children nowadays. 19 they're off, 18 they're off and do
mm-hmm.
their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
No, that time you know, you're still under your parents'
yeah.
guidance,
yeah.
things like that. More I would say generally the values taught at that time really molds the person,
mm-hmm.
you know, molds the person, and no matter where you go later on, it guides you.
Yeah,
values that guide you in your life, anywhere you go.
What did you teach?
I was teaching English and geography based mainly.
Okay.
Mainly. I was an arts person. Huh?
Okay. And then this was secondary school.
Lower secondary.
Okay.
Form 1 to Form 3.
Okay.
I can't do science for nuts. Science and maths. Oh
yeah.
dear.
Yeah.
No problem.
Well, you need to know what you're good at. So.
Huh?
Yeah.
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 My favorite subject was geography. Because I feel geography is a living subject.
Yeah.
History is good. Interesting in that you know what happened.
Mm.
You know? It's more story-like.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas geography is something I feel that every child should learn.
Mm.
Because, hey, you are living in the world.
Yeah.
Why is the sun shining at this time of the year? Why is it monsoon at this time of the year? How come you get durians at this season?
Yeah.
This is all about geography.
Yeah.
Where you live, the weather, people, occupations, agriculture, which I think should never be taken out of the school. It should be a compulsory subject.
Yeah.
It's a living subject.
Yeah.
You know, like people travel a lot nowadays.
Yeah.
You travel, yeah, I've been to Bali, I've been to Paris, I've been to this. Look at the globe. Do you know where it is? You don't.
Mm.
Those who have not studied geography.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really important. Yeah.
yeah. So we know on the globe, when you look at the globe, this is how far this country is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And we used, when we were in school and we studied geography, I remember this geography teacher, she was such a wonderful, a very, very gifted teacher.
Uh-huh.
When she taught geography, she made it come alive. Yeah? And she would always make sure we had an atlas.
Yeah.
Where, which place we were studying, pictures, you know. It was a very interesting subject to me. And then it made you think, one day I hope to visit this country.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
right. I hope that, so when I go to that country, I will know that I will see this and this and
yeah.
this. And what I eat, like for example, when we imported fruits. This fruit come, so for example, they say, they come from Australia. Where's Australia?
Mm.
You know where Australia
mm-hmm.
is. So interesting. Hmm?
Yeah. How long did you teach for?
28 and a half years.
28 and a half.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are so many students you've met and lots
oh, yes,
of stories.
Yes. Students I've met, I don't recognize because just like me,
yeah.
when I was a student and I met my teachers, they would say, who are you? You'd be teaching hundreds of them.
Mm-hmm.
They recognize you, but you don't recognize
yeah,
them
yeah.
for better or for worse, you
no,
know?
Yeah, I know the feeling. Yeah,
yeah
they'll come to me and say my name. I'm like, who are you?
Yeah, yeah. It's the same for everybody.
Yeah.
And some of them are so sophisticated, can't recognize them.
Yeah.
You know? So, and then, but I feel that, well, you're a teacher, you know. You know, it is, I find it, it is a very humbling experience.
Of course.
When a pupil comes up to me and says, hey, you know, remember, do you remember, I'm not going to say the name.
Yeah.
Do you remember, you taught us this poem, or you taught us this story in literature. And till today, they remember it. And I find it so rewarding and humbling that they do remember because I taught them. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, totally. You don't know what will stick, and then there are some things that stick that are surprise you.
Yeah, and of course there's the reverse, the opposite side of the coin, where pupils you might have punished who remember you. I had a pupil. I don't remember her actually.
Uh-huh.
I won't say I don't remember her, but I can't picture her face now. A few years back, that group had a reunion.
Yeah.
And then this girl told one of her classmates, if I meet that teacher, I tell you, I'm going to tell her off. And then this girl came and told me, you know, so and so. I said, who is she? I don't even remember. She said, you threw her out of the class. You threw her book out of her class. Because she didn't finish her work, or she didn't do a homework or something.
Yeah.
But
do you remember doing this?
I don't remember. So many students, see? Because sometimes you know how it is. Like we also used to get on our teachers' nerves, everybody, somewhere along the line, you know? And whatever I said or did then, it must have upset her a lot.
Yeah.
But the thing is this. Today, she is she's a writer.
Mm.
She's a writer. So I told this former student who is now also in her 60s, I said, come to think of it, maybe that turned her around. Perhaps she would not have said, I'll show her, I'll do it. She would not be a writer today.
You demanded the best from her.
So to me, I feel, I look at her, I don't know if she still looks at it that way, but we haven't met. But I think if I meet her now, she'll probably strangle me.
No, not to this day.
So these are the people you meet. It's always like that. I mean, not only in the teaching profession, any profession, but especially so in the teaching profession, because you're molding, minds. And I can't say that, what should I say? If I have in any way touched the life of even one student who has done better now, I feel that I've been rewarded during teaching.
Totally.
Don't you think so?
Yeah.
Huh? Somebody who comes up to you someday who's doing very well in whatever profession he or she is.
Yeah.
And they thank you for it. That is so wonderful. Just recently, you know, I had a friend, former colleague in one of my former schools. She was telling me when she was teaching in Johor, that was it's a small town. And the teachers there, the turnover was not high, so the same teachers more or less followed them from Form 1 to Form 5.
Yeah.
And then they had a reunion. The students of that particular year, the Form 5 year, they had a reunion and they invited all the teachers who had taught them from the time they were in Form 1. Or big group. I think the reunion was sometime last year or something. Mm. And a few of them have become very rich. I mean, big businessmen now. One in particular who owns a big business, is a big businessman in Johor itself.
Yeah.
Whatever company, he's a millionaire, I suppose.
Yeah.
He is arranging in October. He is arranging a gathering, a get-together of all the teachers, his classmates, of those that particular
cohort.
That year.
Yeah.
That year, from 5 years. To the country golf club in that town. And he has booked accommodation in that place Friday, Saturday, Sunday. at his own expense. He's paying for everything.
Are you going to go?
No, no. I wasn't in that school. Oh, okay, I mean, okay. This colleague of mine, my former colleague of mine, who is now living in...
Johor.
In Klang.
Oh, Klang.
Where she was teaching it when she was...
Oh, okay, okay.
Unmarried. She was, she was a teacher there.
Yeah.
So this one, and she, and he wants to make sure, he says, please, everybody come. It will make me so happy. And he's paying for everything. He's booked. He says, confirm with me, yes or no. And he's going to book the whole golf club for them. Accommodation paid for. I don't know, she didn't mention about meals or anything, but I guess that means we want things thrown in.
Yeah.
But definitely accommodation.
Yeah.
And arranging a special program.
Wow.
Whatever celebration. How wonderful that is.
Yeah.
Appreciating the teachers.
Yeah.
Really appreciating the teachers. It's very good.
That is really wonderful. Mm. Yeah.
And so in each one in a little way, if you're appreciated, that's the most beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You don't have to do something dynamic and big.
Yeah.
What is it? Ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
Huh? So you've never thought about doing anything else other than teaching?
Well, at that time, like I said, at that time, you know, those were the options open to us. And the nurses, girls who became nurses or the guys who became male nurses, they were so dedicated.
Yeah.
They were very dedicated and they were under such strict discipline.
Yeah.
I remember my second sister. In fact, all my sisters, even except Uncle Ling and I are the only ones not nurses.
They are nurses.
Uncle Fred also, male nursing, he went to England to study. And the training they received at that time was so intense, so strict. They were such good nurses compared to what you have now.
Yeah.
I know I shouldn't, it's not for me to run them, but you know, it's not
it's not the same standard you're saying.
Yeah, you know, now that there's no such thing as you see a nurse at that time sitting around doing nothing.
Yeah.
You know? Or passing the buck to somebody.
Yeah.
They were on the go and they were so compassionate.
Yeah.
It wasn't just, I go in, do this, come out, take my salary and come out. No.
Yeah.
They were compassionate to the patients. They did their work with diligence. Really, it's something that is not there now.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you want to start?